calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana on a rainy day. Yeah, we got a rainy day here. Of course, we had a rainy day yesterday, too. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. And any other donations that you'd like to send us to help with our programs. We've got a pretty big bill to put out each month for our website that is not cheap. So anyone out there that would like to contribute towards that, we appreciate that too. Okay. Well, let's see what's cooking here. First of all, I got to make the rounds around here, stick my head in here at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and see what's happening, okay? Yeah. Hey, how you boys doing in there? Getting started pretty early for Friday, man. Jeez, Christmas, I'm telling you. Got Hank Snow in there this morning playing for the boys, but Friday morning? At least you wait till noon, man. Yeah, right. I'm getting out of here. All right, what's cooking here? Well, are we going to go to war again? I'm not going to war yet, still, or again, man. Yeah, they're playing around with it, but I want to gather up all those Fox TV people and all those John McCainers and all of those right-winger types and say, you want to go to war? Hey, here's a soup pan, put it over your head, and here's a rifle, and here's about 100 rounds of ammo. You're all set, boy. Take off. You know, they still talk about the Koch brothers quite a bit. And the interesting thing about the Koch brothers, a bunch of crooks, there's no doubt about that, got their first nest egg money off dealing with Joseph Stalin. Prior to World War II. So, right-wingers, forget about that. Yeah, the Koch brothers, they have this other name they fly under when they're trying to sneak up on you. Because when I went, you know, a couple of years ago, when the Tea Party first started making sounds, I went up there to the courthouse. I told you that. And I looked around there, and of course they had to pray for a half an hour before they got to the main situation. And I saw this great big bus out there on the curb, you know, probably $100,000 bus. I'm telling you, all equipped and painted up and everything, New American Enterprise or Progress or something like that. And I walked up to that guy and said, "Hey, isn't that the Koch brothers stuff?" And he said, "What do you mean?" Well, I said, "You know the Koch brothers, don't you? They finance this deal." "No, I don't know the Koch brothers." The driver didn't want to even admit he knew them. Well, anyhow, the right goes after Soros and the left go after the Koch brothers. And they're both right, because both Soros and the Koch brothers are billionaires. And they're up to their ass in manipulating politics. I don't think I ever played this for you, so we're going to have a little education this morning about the Koch brothers. And then later on we'll do something about Mr. Soros. He's a Jew out of Hungary, I believe. Yeah, he's the billionaire on the left, and the Koch brothers are the billionaires allegedly on the right. I don't think the billionaires are ever on anybody's side, really. But they pretend to be libertarians. So let's hear the history of the Koch brothers.
Lewis Daniel Shulman's new book about the Koch brothers is called Sons of Wichita. In the 2012 campaign, David Axelrod, President Obama's chief strategist, called the Koch brothers political contract killers.
Right. And that was that might have been the kindest thing that they were called during that election. They certainly became boogeymen. What was interesting about the Obama campaign's response is during the 2012 campaign, it was sometimes hard to tell whether Obama was running around against Mitt Romney or against the Koch brothers. the Obama campaign saw the Kochs as a serious threat in terms of outside money, along with the groups that Karl Rove was running. And they found early on that the best way to help to neutralize some of the ads that Americans for Prosperity was running was to make sure that they were tied to the Koch brothers. So whenever somebody saw an AFP ad, they would know that two petrochemical billionaires were the hidden hands, essentially, behind this group. And they found that strategy to be quite effective at blunting some of the impact of these ads that AFP was running relentlessly.
Have the Koch brothers also worked to discredit climate change?
They have given quite a bit of money over the years to a web of groups that have so doubt about the existence of climate change. There's no question about that. And that is one thing that I've wrestled with a little bit in the research and writing of my book, because, you know, one thing I believe about the Koch brothers is that they are very much true believers. They're not simply out there to line their pockets. They believe that the ideas that they're advocating are the best course for America. On the other hand, you know, debunking climate change is clearly in their economic self-interest. I could see them from an anti-regulatory standpoint battling any climate change-related policies. But trying to create doubt about the existence of it is another matter entirely, especially since I consider both Charles and David to be men of science. They are very smart, technical guys, attended MIT, both have earned advanced degrees in engineering from MIT. These are not, it seems a little bit disingenuous to me to be pursuing that type of strategy.
How would you summarize their influence in American politics today?
I think the reason that we're talking about libertarianism in general owes a lot to Charles Koch. That really is his legacy. When he started out, this was very much a fringe philosophy, but it's very much been a mainstream school of thought in America today. And I really think that has a lot to do with Charles Koch, just because many of the institutions, the think tanks, the academic programs that have helped to sort of get these ideas out there have been bankrolled by Charles and, in some cases, David.
Have they funded any philanthropies?
Yes. There's sort of an interesting distinction between Charles and David in their philanthropy. As someone characterized it to me, David is very much a true philanthropist in the mold of an Andrew Carnegie or something like that. He's given hundreds of millions of dollars to medical research. David has struggled with prostate cancer for about 20 years at this point, and it's incurable. But so he needs to sort of stay one step ahead of it. A lot of his money has gone into cancer research, but he's also given a huge amount of money to the arts in New York City. I was just there last week, and it's hard to go a few blocks without running into something that David has funded. You've got the David Koch Theater at Lincoln Center, the David Koch Plaza at the Met, the dinosaur wing at the Natural History Museum is underwritten by David Koch as well. So he considers the arts and medical research really the thrust of his philanthropy, and politics has really come second. Now, Charles Koch, his philanthropy is really focused on education and public policy. That has been his mission since the 60s. He and his wife certainly give to other causes, particularly in the Wichita area where they live. Salvation Army has received a lot of money from the Kochs, Boys and Girls Club, that sort of thing.
But they're very private. I mean, you don't see these guys on the Sunday talk shows.
Extraordinarily private. And this is something that harkens back to their father, who was also a very private man, part of which I think traces to his involvement with the John Birch Society when he comes under scrutiny for some of the things that he's saying in speeches and that sort of thing. But they've always just been a very private clan, every one of them.
What about their influence on American business?
I think Charles will be thought of as one of the greatest businessmen of his generation. He is certainly a model for future businessmen in that he's basically taken a mid-sized oil and cattle ranching empire and transformed it into this international giant. You know, one thing that Charles prides himself upon is his management philosophy, which is called market-based management. It is a libertarian-tinged management philosophy where he's tried to create free market conditions within his company. They've done that by creating internal markets where business divisions essentially trade between each other. And he's tried to harness the entrepreneurial instincts of his employees. He doesn't want kind of just worker drones that just go about their day-to-day without thinking about how the things that they're doing could be improved. And so he's tried to align the incentives within the company to get people to feel like they're taking some ownership of their jobs. And he really credits this market-based management philosophy to the extraordinary success of Koch Industries.
A Koch Industries spokesman said neither David nor Charles Koch was interviewed for the book. What about Bill or Frederick? Did they talk to you?
I didn't interview Bill. He was not interested in talking for the book. I was able to spend some time with Frederick, which was a pretty fascinating experience. He didn't have anything to do with the family company, wasn't interested in it from an early age. He ends up getting a playwriting master's degree from Yale and spends his life really as a patron of the arts. And he has, around the world, he's bought a series of historic homes that he's rehabilitated in just the most sort of fastidious way. And he, during the 80s, he spent quite a bit of time acquiring a variety of interesting, basically historical documents, the scores of Stravinsky, the cocktail napkin, doodles of Jean Cocteau, all this artistic ephemera that gives insight into the way that artists, writers, musicians work. He really brought all this together, and it's now part of a collection at Yale, which is just a fascinating resource for scholars. I visited Frederick at his Upper East Side mansion, which is interesting because it's this fabulous house, seven stories. Woolworth, the dime store magnate, actually had this house built for one of his daughters at the turn of the century. And this was another place that Frederick rehabbed. Interestingly, he doesn't actually live there. He has an apartment on Fifth Avenue down the block. This is kind of just his private museum, and it's filled with just remarkable artwork. One of the most fascinating things in the home is he actually has Mary Antoinette's bed, canopied bed, that was given to her as a wedding gift from the mayor of Paris. It's very, obviously, quite rare. And Frederick, at the end of our conversation, presented me with a legal agreement saying, essentially, everything you write about me, everyone you talk to about me, any secondary research will have to be vetted by me. And if I don't approve, then it doesn't go in the manuscript. Obviously, I could not sign that as a journalist, and that's where our conversations ended.
What about friends and business associates of the Kochs? Were they willing to talk to you?
I spoke to a great many friends, extended members of the family, people actually going back to the grade school days of the Koch brothers, fraternity brothers, people who worked for the company, those sorts of things. So it wasn't easy, but it was a process of getting a lot of people to open up, but it did happen.
What's the most startling thing you learned?
What's the most startling thing I learned? That's an interesting question. One of the things that really I was taken aback by was the brutality of the battle between the brothers. You wouldn't expect people to treat their worst enemies like this, but this was how the Koch brothers did battle. I mean, I alluded to this earlier, but at one point, Bill was essentially trying to get his brothers, Charles and David, branded as criminals. And he was aware of this, and he basically said, you know, this is war. Anything goes. And this was a scorched earth battle. You know, you have Mary Koch in the middle of this, in all this crossfire, trying desperately to bring peace to her family before she dies. And I managed to get a hold of some of her correspondence from that time between her sons, and it's just devastating. She tried everything in her power to bring this war under control, and she couldn't. her final last-ditch attempt was to insert a clause in her will saying that if any of her sons were suing the other ones at the time of her death, they would be disinherited. She felt that this might quell this war. Of course, the only thing it did, because Bill and Frederick were, of course, engaged in litigation at this point against Charles and David, the only thing it did was ignite another round of litigation, this time contesting her will.
Have any of the Koch brothers read your book? Have they commented on it?
Well, I did get a call from one of David's close friends when the book came out, and he said he was going to be in Palm Beach over Memorial Day weekend with David, and they asked me to send a copy down so they could review it. So perhaps they have.
What's your takeaway from all of this research? What do we absolutely need to know about the Koch brothers?
You know, I think the main thing to understand is that their legacy in politics, in business, in culture, medical research even, is so much more significant than people realize. And you know, just if you look just at the company Koch Industries, you know, I defy you to go through a day without encountering a product that they produced or has passed through the company in some way, shape, or form. I look at the Kochs as a historic dynasty on par with the Rockefellers or someone of that nature whose legacy is going to extend well beyond our lifetimes, and their impact is going to be felt for many, many years to come.
Thank you.
Well, there's two segments there. Wait a minute until I get my mic up here. Two segments there, and I got the one cart before the horse, so now I'm going to play the first segment on the Koch brothers, so stand by.
SXM Public Radio. I'm talking to journalist Daniel Shulman about his new book, Sons of Wichita. The youngest Koch brothers, the twins, David and Bill, very different personalities, right?
Very different personalities. Charles, David, and Bill are all quite tall. David and Bill are verging on 6'5". David was always a very gifted athlete, even-tempered guy, very popular. He was basically the star player of the MIT basketball team. In fact, records he set there were not broken until a couple years ago. Bill felt like the family geek. He was a little bit awkward. He also had a bit of a volatile temperament, which from his account, it sounds like his brothers liked to provoke. But David and Bill were known for getting into really brutal brawls when they were growing up. So brutal, in fact, that the property foreman who squired them around with their friends to movies and things like that carried a set of boxing gloves for when they started battling each other, just to make sure that they didn't actually seriously injure each other. But Bill and David were quite close at the same time as well. They lived together in the same fraternity house at MIT and were very close.
David and Charles run the family business now. What about Bill?
Bill started his successful energy company in the early 80s after he was ousted from Koch Industries. This is now a multi-billion dollar company, and he had begun in geothermal and alternative energy. Now he's really making his money the old-fashioned way in sort of mining, and his company Oxbow is also one of the largest suppliers of something called petroleum coke, which is essentially a byproduct of the refining process that you can also burn as a fuel source. It's kind of like a coal-like fuel source. And he sells a lot of this in the Asia-Pacific market.
You write about a Christmas dinner with the four brothers at their childhood home with their mother in 1979, and it did not go well.
What happens there is this is at the time when Bill is having a lot of trepidations about the company. He's also worried because a lawyer for the company has approached him recently with a draft estate plan that has been drafted up for him. He notices that it basically says that upon his death, you know, his shares will be sold back to the company at a price that he thinks is ridiculously low. And he also believes his brother Charles is running the company like a dictator. Here you have a situation where these three brothers each control the same amount of shares in Koch Industries, but Charles is the one that really has to say about the direction that the company is moving in. So at this Christmas dinner, a lot of ill feelings boil over. Bill is lambasting Charles. He's lambasting his mom. And his mom gets up from the table and runs out of the room crying. And this is the last Christmas that the Kochs would have together as a family. And this was a very important holiday to Mary Koch, as you know, as it is to a lot of mothers. But this was the time of year when her four sons would get together with her. And in the years since, she would plead with her sons to try to heal this rift in the family so they could celebrate Christmas again. But it wouldn't happen.
Did the brothers really hire private investigators against each other during their 20-year legal battles over the business?
There were many private investigators involved. Bill was accused of hiring private investigators that were actually bribing trash collectors for the garbage of Charles, David, and their lawyers, according to their lawyers. And Bill alleged that someone had infiltrated his office, he believed from Koch Industries, or hired by Koch Industries, and was stealing sensitive documents. Went as far as to create a situation where he created a false document and they left it on the desk of one of their lawyers. And his side claims that this false document later ended up popping up in a legal filing by Koch Industries in that case.
Which side ultimately won in Koch versus Koch?
Koch Industries was found guilty of misrepresentation, but the jury also found that it wasn't material, which meant that the damages, the billion-dollar damages that Bill, Frederick, and the other dissident shareholders were seeking, there wouldn't be any damages. So basically that was sort of the end of the case. It was sort of a big nothing. But at the same time, Bill, he was really launching lawsuit after lawsuit. He was pursuing this aggressively with every means at his disposal. This included assisting a Senate investigation that was probing oil theft by Koch Industries and other oil producers from Native American lands. The Senate ends up producing a report accusing Koch of systemic theft from Native American lands. And at that point, Bill files a whistleblower lawsuit accusing the company and its brothers of stealing oil.
Koch Industries repeatedly ran afoul of the Department of Energy, the IRS, and other federal agencies in the 1990s for what kinds of violations, and have they been chastened in any way?
So in the 90s, Koch Industries comes under investigation by the Department of Justice and the EPA for a host of environmental catastrophes with its pipeline system and its tanks. Essentially, these things are leaking left and right. Thousands of gallons of oil are being spilled into wetlands and waterways in a handful of states. So that's one part of it. Koch Industries also has, in 1996, a Koch pipeline explodes in Texas, not far from Dallas, kills two teenagers in the most grisly of ways. And essentially, it ends up being that there's a $296 million wrongful death jury verdict against Koch Industries, the largest in the nation's history at that time. And that was no accident. Testimony and evidence in that case showed that the company was taking what you could call a shockingly cavalier approach to safety. There was one deposition in that case of a Koch employee discussing how he wanted to perform maintenance on a Koch pipeline. And his supervisor essentially says, well, you know, you have to understand that at Koch, you know, this is an aggressively profit-driven company. It's basically less costly for us to keep this money invested elsewhere. And if there's a disaster, you know, we can come back and pay off the lawsuit, and that will cost us less in the end. So there were a lot of problems at the company at that point. The end of the Clinton administration, Koch Industries is indicted on 97 felony counts and a few of its employees for a release of benzene from its refinery in Corpus Christi. So it's just really one thing after the other. But it does prompt a change in how Koch Industries was doing business. I mean, among other things, it starts to radically downscale its pipelines because from a regulatory perspective, they're just too much trouble. But Charles Koch also has a realization. He's a free market purist guy, and he operates his company as a free market microcosm within the company. He tries to create those conditions. But clearly, in the world outside, it's not a pure free market economy. There are regulations that we have to abide by. There are regulators. And I think this series of run-ins he had with the EPA and the Department of Justice changed his attitude. And you really see the company make a lot of strides since then. I mean, these days they actually earn a lot of environmental awards at some of their operations.
David and Charles Koch are the sixth richest guys in the world. At what point did they start funneling their money into political causes?
For Charles, this really begins in the 1960s. He grows interested in the fledgling libertarian movement, and he decides that changing the political culture, mainstreaming libertarian ideas, is going to be his philanthropic legacy. In the 70s, he co-founds the Cato Institute, and he bankrolls a youth outreach arm called Students for a Libertarian Society. He buys a libertarian magazine called Libertarian Review, and meanwhile, he's helping to strengthen and fund the Libertarian Party. Up until this point, David Koch has not been too involved with politics, though he certainly shares his father's and his brother's free enterprise sensibilities. Charles approaches both of his brothers, Bill and David, before the 19 election, wondering if either of them want to run as a vice presidential candidate. The reason for this is strategic, because by having someone who's very wealthy run, they can self-fund their campaign and circumvent campaign finance regulations. David ends up going for it, running for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket in 1980, and that's really when his political involvement begins. The 1980 election is interesting because in some ways libertarianism is a pretty radical philosophy, and there was a lot of internal discussion within the movement about how to express their ideas in a way that frankly didn't scare people, because we're talking about, in some ways, it borders on anarchism in terms of the level of government that they're advocating, getting rid of the income tax, no Social Security, these sorts of things. These are not the warmest and fuzziest of ideas. So what happens in the libertarian movement is it's largely bankrolled by Charles Koch at this point. It's basically entirely orbiting around his wallet, and his brother's running for the vice presidency on the Libertarian Party ticket. A lot of libertarians felt as if he and his running mate were sort of diluting libertarian ideas too much. They weren't expressing them in a radical enough way. The movement essentially implodes after that election. Charles and David Koch realize they wanted to work through the third way. They were no fans of Republicans at that point. They realized they have to take a more pragmatic approach. And that's where you sort of gradually see them making this three-decade climb to where they are as Republican power brokers.
Instrumental in creating and promoting the Tea Party movement.
Absolutely. What I find interesting about that is the steps that the company took, Koch Industries, in the 2010 timeframe to distance the brothers from the Tea Party, when at the same time it was absolutely evident that Americans for Prosperity, a company that they had co-founded and were helping to finance, was organizing Tea Party rallies and was quite instrumental in fanning the flames of discontent that the Tea Party seized upon.
Daniel Shulman is a senior editor at Mother Jones.
Well, even though I got the cart before the horse there, I think you can put it together. And that big bus I talked to you about, he just explained to us, was Americans for Prosperity. That was the Koch brothers' cover as they bought the Tea Party movement. So these people that keep talking about the Tea Party as a grassroots working man type outfit, it's something they, most of the people in the Tea Party, I guess, don't even know it, but they're being maneuvered by billionaires that would make some of the trust type people of the Teddy Roosevelt's time blush, the railroad magnates and so forth. And back when there was really no support for the working man, hardly any unions. With the only time they got any place is when they went out and got violent. And that's why Teddy Roosevelt had to come up with the trust buster deal. Right now it would be equivalent to busting up corporations. But, yeah. But anyhow, it was interesting how the man that was in charge of the bus, I don't think he was a bus driver, but the man in charge of quite an operation there was standing there in the middle of the Tea Party people, denying that the bus was owned by the Koch brothers. Well, why wouldn't you say, well, yeah, it is, you know. He's a good guy. These guys are great. Interesting, that transition. They didn't go into that. Maybe in the book they did, but how their father came up with a oil process and he went over and sold it to Joseph Stalin and made a lot of money off that deal. So essentially he was working directly with the Communist Party, comes back and then over the years twists around getting the John Birch Society, became a libertarian, the kids. That's weird, sort of a Manchurian candidate thing if you ask me. Well, I see Obama's taking the bait, sending more military advisors to Iraq. Remember Vietnam? I know most people don't remember anything. That's how we got started in Vietnam. Only in this situation, we're going back to a situation like Vietnam. Once you get the advisors in there, all they have to do is place a rocket, right, and kill a bunch of American troops. And away you go. The public goes crazy, fanatically crazy. We got to get them, we got to get them. And there you go. You're up to your ass in war again. The reason most of the crooks get away with what they get away with in politics is, number one, they got the money. And number two, they manipulate people's memories so that they don't remember what went before. You know, history is what I call linkage. It's sort of like when you throw a flat rock across the water and how it skips, hits and hits and hits and hits and finally goes down. Well, if you don't look at linkage, you know, if you're going to look at like the Jews, their so-called Holocaust, whether, you know, I'm not even arguing about how many got iced, but what I'm saying is linkage. You can't talk about what happened in the Second World War without talking about what happened in the First World War. Because without the First World War, most of the things that led up to the Second World War wouldn't have happened. So who do you blame from back there? Well, the Jews were buying up everything they could after World War I in Germany. People were eating out of garbage cans and so forth, which moved German people more to be anti-Jewish. Of course they did, because they could see the big shot Jews, the Jew bankers, the Jew industrialists, and so forth, doing fine, and they were starving to death. And also the boycotting of Germany by the Western powers, of putting a blockade around Germany. Not only that they'd been had the crap kicked out of them, but now they put this blockade around and then started dismantling all the French and English and everybody, dismantling German industry and taking it out. So to understand the mentality of people who will go for Adolf Hitler, you got to understand what went before. And if you're going to talk to a Jew and argue, they're going to argue about how many Jews died in World War II, say, well, let's go back to World War I, where that all started. It's sort of like the way I look at the State of Israel. Well, what the hell is that all about? Well, it started with the Balfour Declaration, ceding Palestine, both to the Jews and the Turks, as I recall, at the same time, which guaranteed a lot of problems. But with the Balfour Declaration, things were just sort of perking along, not really getting too far. You had the Stern Gang and Menachem Begin and his underground and his guerrilla operations. And the high point, I guess, was the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. But that still didn't really get Israel really going. So what did? Well, they needed something really big. You know, like 9/11. Really, really, really big. Well, looks like these Western powers, and Germany's taking the bait, they're going to get into a pissing contest and another war. So Jaime says to Abraham, well, what do you think? Could we sacrifice some people and get this Israel thing really going? Well, what do you mean? Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of Jews in Germany that are assimilated Germanically. They don't look Jewish. They don't look Ashkenaz. I mean, they don't look like Khazars. They look like just regular Aryans in Germany. And they're sort of thumbing their nose at the elders of Zion. They feel they're becoming more German than they are Jews. So why can't we design something to punish them? I force the ones that are left to get back in the harness and work for the elders of Zion. Well, how are we going to do that? Well, let's radicalize the situation in Germany and take it beyond just deporting troublemaking Jews or criminal Jews and just racially unacceptable Jews. Anybody that's Jewish or says they're Jewish or may have some Jew thing in their way in the background, let's get them all. Yeah, we know what's going to happen. They're trying to move them out into Eastern Europe, and it's going to break down. And there's going to be hundreds of thousands of them die. Well, what better excuse to push the Israel thing? Now we got to have Israel, man. Look at this. All these Jews died. I'll tell you what. I think it's plausible that the Jews would sacrifice hundreds of thousands, at least, of their own people to get what they want. Well, they do it, you know, all the time in other ways to get what they want. So you got to understand linkage. Now, I can't wait for you to run this scenario by a Jew. Oh, he's going to go crazy. That could never be. Our elders would never do that just to get the Israeli state. Well, what do you mean? You could. Israel would be the stepping stone to having major power in the world. In fact, almost take over the world, and a stepping stone to taking over the United States by proxy. Anyhow, what do you think of that, boys and girls? But always look at the linkage between things that happen and when you're considering what the end result was. Why did this happen? Let's go way back there and start putting the puzzles together instead of just dealing, oh, the Germans killed all those Jews. Bad. Well, what was going on? What was this Balfour Declaration? What what was going on, that they were having problems really getting Israel going. I mean, they were, you know, they had some uprisings there and knocked a few people off, and they had the Irgun and like that, but they really weren't moving towards it, and the British were sort of keeping them under lock and key too. So anyhow, that may sound a little bizarre to you, but that's what's been playing on my mind for a long time, that there are people so fucking evil that they'd give up half of their race or half of their people to get what they really want. Because technically, a major part of the Jews, I mean, racially, they come in all races. So it's not really a racial loyalty. And a large percentage of Jews, especially now, are atheists. And then you got all your conservative, you got your liberal, you got your different Jews, which really means that the only cohesion they've got is where you can push so-called anti-Semitism and have an occasional killing off of a few to drive them back into a solid front. And I think a lot of anti-Jewish activity is looked upon with favor by the elders to keep them in line. You know, all this nonsense about getting Maliki over there in Iraq to suddenly become inclusive and that's going to calm things down is total 100% bullshit. And anybody that knows anything knows that. The Sunnis, Shiites, and all these people have hated each other for maybe 1,000 years. I mean, you know, goes all the way back to Muhammad. They're not going to come together. There's only one way they come together, and that's if the U.S. puts more troops in. When the U.S. war machine puts a lot of troops in there, then they do come together. They'll come together to kill Americans. And then once the Americans are gone, they go back to killing each other. And they kill each other anyhow. But Maliki, where is he going to run to? Are they going to let him run to the United States and live in Miami? Maybe. Like Batista. I was watching a documentary about Fidel Castro last night. The Untold Story of Fidel Castro. I think everybody should watch that because it shows Castro to be not quite the monster everybody, the right wing, and what I was led to believe in the John Birch Society. Many of the things he was alleviating were bad, bad things that dictator Batista and the capitalists were using against the Cuban people. And I leaned over to my gal and I said, you know, I hate to admit this, but if I was a Cuban and I'd lived at that time and knew what was going on, I might have gone with Castro. I could never have gone with Batista. So anyhow, it's interesting, you know, going back in my John Birch Society days, how they had my mind all screwed around. It was all communism. I lived, slept, and ate anti-communism. Go to all the meetings, join all the groups, be a leader in the John Birch Society. A whole lot of what I was getting was bullshit. And at this late date, I've begun to figure that out. And, of course, that's why, too, I've moved to more of a leftist position. Not liberal, like you know, but, well, I don't know. There's some parts of me are liberal. You know, these terms are hard to define. But when it comes to understanding that our government has been supporting dictators since so far back, it's hard to imagine when they didn't. And we were supporting dictators and saying, well, if we don't support dictators, the communists are going to get us. Well, in many cases, the fact that we did support dictators caused the communists to get us. Look at Korea. If we'd have stayed out of it, no matter which way it went, we'd have stayed out of it. Now we've been there, what, 60 years? In Korea? And now they're stoking it up against this stupid little guy in North Korea. He's threatening the capitalists in South Korea. Well, that's okay with me. We've got billions of dollars in U.S. industry that have moved to South Korea. And if something should happen to South Korea that caused all those corporations to say, shit, we can't make it here anymore. We better go back to U.S. That'd be fine with me. But look at all these dictators that we've supported. And the excuse was always anti-communism. And a lot of times it was just guerrilla warfare and nationalists that we were fighting. So that's why I just don't, I can't have much truck anymore at all with the right wing, because they still are hanging on to those vestiges of the John Birch Society that some were true and some exaggerated and some were downright lies. And you see here the Koch brothers, they were involved in the John Birch Society too. Anyhow, it's introspection is very interesting to think back on what guided me for a lot of my life. I wish I'd have become more racist sooner and not spend so much time on anti-communism. But anyhow, at least I know now. You know, down there in Ghana, they got a Kenyatta as the president down there. He must be the son of Jomo Kenyatta. And our political leaders treat him with such respect. Well, we have a poor memory of what Jomo Kenyatta was doing to white people in Ghana way back then, way back in the 60s. I have books in my library with the pictures of the torture and so forth he inflicted on men, women, and children when he was in the Mau Mau, which was a bloodthirsty nigger gang. And so here he is being treated like a prince, and nobody ever talks about his past or his family's past. You get all these young, usually even white, girl reporters going down there to give us the news on Africa with a total misunderstanding or not understanding at all the nature of the Negro. Yep, the nature of the Negro. Because they're thinking equality. They're just like us, only they're black. Wrong. Wrong. Oh, man, I'll tell you, it's enough to... Well, you know what I usually say, and I'm not going to say it. Yesterday I was listening to this gal who went from the L.A. Times down there to Africa. Sounded like she was about 16. I'm sure she was in her 20s. With a total... not understanding of blacks and how the Sudanese of the south and the Arabs of the North Sudan Arabs are lighter, maybe a little more white blood in them, and they enslaved the blacks in the South. Well, I've always had a theory about that. You only can be a slave if you allow yourself to be a slave. You know, they tried to enslave the Mongoloid Indians on the plantations in the South and the West, I guess. It didn't work. Blacks thrived under slavery. Yeah, they really thrived under slavery, even though there was some bad things happened. It was mostly pretty good things, three hots and a cot. But when they tried it with Indians, it didn't work out. So it ended up the Indians became plantation owners and enslaved blacks down there in the Carolinas. The head of the Cherokee Nation built a Scotch castle, just like in Europe, down there. He had his own army, his own police force, his own constitution, everything else. Plus, he had plantations all over the place with black slaves. You can enslave a white man for a while. You can enslave an Asian man for a while, but ultimately, they'll break loose. But Negroes, somebody's got to do it for them. They'll never break loose on their own. I mean, that plantation system would still be running if it depended on blacks to liberate. In fact, just about everything that blacks have achieved in the last, since the 50s, has been handed to them on a silver platter. I mean, the whole civil rights movement run by rat whites and Jews. And so I white congressmen passing the laws to give the blacks a leg up. They talk about their struggle. There was no struggle. You know, Martin Luther King had a few marches, got roughed up a little bit. But for the most part, the only struggle would have been a little bit of Malcolm X burning down a few Jew stores in Washington, D.C. But for the most part, the bulk of the black people, they didn't struggle for it at all. I remember in San Diego going to a Martin Luther King Day parade just to see what was going on. And within three blocks of where the parade route was, there was all these black neighborhoods. They were out there barbecuing and washing their cars and all that stuff. They weren't interested in that damn parade. And most people, most of the blacks, they say, oh, Martin Luther King was wonderful. They just say that. They just say that. But anyhow, they can't get there anywhere unless they're riding on the back of the white race. Or sometimes maybe the Asian race, but the Asian race won't let them ride on their back. You see countries around where there's a many Chinese in business in Africa, they don't take crap off blacks. You think whiteys mean to blacks? Well, you watch a Chinaman or other Asians. Oh, once in a while you'll find a one that says they love the blacks and all that, all that kind of stuff. But most of the time they don't give the blacks an out at all. Do the job or we'll take care of you. Just like the Koreans there in South L.A. when the Rodney King riots. The Koreans grabbed their AR-15s. They're up on the roof. They're shooting those bastards. They're shooting at them. And the blacks learned not to go after the Korean stores. You see? No, it's the white race that is always giving a leg up to blacks. They just never have gotten the message. Put them off on their own plantation or whatever and let them struggle for whatever they can struggle for, but get them out of our face. Get them off our back. Physically separate them. Then they got no excuse. That's why most blacks don't want separation. They may talk separation. Maybe they think they can get some money out of it, but they don't really want separation. That's why Whitey goes to Alaska. Pretty soon you got blacks up in Alaska. If Whitey went to the North Pole and built a little village up there, wouldn't be long till Rastas came through. They keep talking about how hateful the white race is towards blacks. Well, why in the hell do you follow us around? I mean, why every place we go, we can't get rid of you? I mean, you know, some of the whites want to bring them along because they're lazy and want to have house niggers and stuff like that. But mostly, they just follow along because they know Whitey's going to make some money. They're going to create something. They're going to even have some low-level jobs for Blackie. But now they want the high-level jobs. And now you got the mulattoes. That was the cleverest thing the Jews came up with, just like they did off the coast of Africa a long time ago. They developed a strain of Jews that were black just to go into Africa and sell out the blacks. Well, I guess that's a true story. I don't know. But it makes sense. Because, you know, the average white guy is not going to bed down with a full-blooded Negro. I mean, he must be nuts if he does, because they're ugly. There's no beauty to them. Big fat ass, big fat lips, the whole bit. So Jew boy says, okay, we'll design a coffee-colored mulatto with certain amount of white blood, and we'll make movie stars out of them and everything. We'll get these white boys because we know white boys. I mean, the white boys, you know, get drunk, they'll screw anything. But they'll be lusting after these coffee-colored mulattoes. And all of a sudden, now all your ads are mulattoes. All your movie stars are becoming mulattoes. White leading men kissing, hugging, and screwing mulattoes. You think that was all an accident? No. It was very well planned. And Whitey fell right into the trap, as he always does. Because the majority of the race, I'm sorry to say, are dumb. They may be a little smarter in some ways than the blacks, but they act dumb. And the leadership sells out, of course. And that's what happens. So if you don't like what's going on, put a knife to the throat of the leadership and the ruling class if you want things to change. That's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Saturn's Day. And we'll see if we can't offend more people out there. 14-5. And shut up.